This feature has been brought to you by Slot Foundation, which needs your support to continue projects like these. Information on this recording and access to other recordings is available online at slot.org.
On Saturday, the Russian Foreign Ministry posted an audio file on its Facebook page with new automated telephone switchboard message options for Russian embassies. To arrange a call from a Russian diplomat to your political opponent, press 1. The recording begins. To use the services of Russian hackers, please press 2. To request election interference, press 3. The officer on duty did not give his name in line with Russian general conduct, but confirmed to the Associated Press that the post was an official joke. You know how funny it is when you have to tell it was a joke. April Fool's Day, there's a lot more where it came from. Russia is a big country. The mural of Cheskauskas, Make Everything Great Again, used for the poster of this lecture, is based on the famous kiss exchanged between Erich Honecker, East German premier, and Leonid Brezhnev, leader of the unfree world in 1979, the face of the Cold War, who also happened to look like one of the extras in the original Planet of the Apes. The fraternal kiss was an actual propaganda photograph, which became the inspiration for the iconic mural on the East Side Gallery in Berlin in the 90s. In case you don't know, the East Side Gallery in Berlin is a section of the Berlin Wall that was left as a memorial covered with murals by artists from all over the world. It's claimed to be the largest and longest open-air gallery in the West. On the very day I gave the first version of this lecture, I had an emergency landing on my way to Paris. The flight attendant told me to breathe normally, which became the motto of my talk at Sciences Po. The morning after the American election, Hungarian Prime Minister Viktor Orban welcomed the results in a live radio interview. Brexit was a knock on the door, but with the American election, we have crossed the threshold, he stated, using his trademark metaphorical language. It was not clear on what threshold we have crossed, whether a new era or the threshold of human consciousness, or perhaps of pain, but he also referred to a popular Hungarian song written by a good friend of mine, Our Uncle Called Reality Has Written a Letter to Us. 2 days later, he visited Theresa May in London, which was cheered by the Hungarian independent media as Our Uncle Reality Has Gone to Downing Street. While in England, he also gave an interview to the Daily Telegraph, seemingly in a great mood, claiming that the American election result is good for Hungary and good for Europe because Trump is against illegal immigration and the export of democracy, which has destabilized many regions before. And here I am quoting the transcript of his interview on November 11th, which could reveal a little more on what he has meant by illiberal democracy earlier that year. This is not a translation, but his own words. Orban had a postgraduate fellowship in Oxford, paid by Soros Foundation, when he was a young revolutionary back in the day. So these are Orban's own words in English. The liberal non-democracy is over. Laughter. What a day! What a day! What a day! And a little further down. The ideology which created its own language of political correctness created a grey uniform approach to all of these questions. Now it is over. What has happened is that reality has broken through the ideology. We are now moving back to reality, which means the views of real people and what they think, how they approach these questions, not to educate them, but accept them as they are, because they are the basis of democracy. If you look at the actor who impersonates reality on the stage of world politics at this moment, we see a reality show star, which may imply that reality has become a form of entertainment. To add to the feeling, the interviewer from Telegraph asked Orban the following. If we were conducting this interview 3 years from now, 3 years into a Trump administration, 3 years into Brexit, where would we be? To which Orban quips enthusiastically, I'm not going to do the accent, is the world falling apart? You know, I understand that feeling, but I have a totally different feeling. I feel I'm being liberated. I did a little bit of the accent I shouldn't have. From this morning on, breathing is easier. So I like it. laughs. The limitations of thinking and speech and discussion and issues that are not permitted to be discussed as we would like is over. I have a feeling of freedom. It's a good thing, not a bad thing. I understand that it is perceived by many people as a threat. That's normal. Freedom is like that. But it's a new age and a lot of issues could be rediscussed. And that is good, not bad, because we are not happy. If you look at the people, especially in the middle class all over the Western world, they are disillusioned, they feel they are being neglected, not just in the US, but in Europe. I think renewal is necessary now in Western political thinking, and it has started. So the Telegraph goes. So is this a creative destruction, Orbán? You can say that, laughs excitedly, though it's a dangerous expression, but accurate. Liberal non-democracy is over, and now we are going back to democracy. Telegraph. I'm still not clear how we square the circle between your vision of Europe and the survival of the European Union, Orbán. We have to start with the question, who creates politics? My answer is the people. Those who elect and those who are elected. And if the number of guys who think like me, or similarly, or at least belong to the same club, and the number is growing, then the circle will be squared. It's impossible to do it alone, but the number of leaders growing and growing, and we will do it. We will reshape Europe. I think it's educational to quote the end of the transcript as well. Orbán. Interesting times. I am electrified. That's good. And what if it all goes bang? Asked the Telegraph. Orbán. That's freedom. Freedom comes with risks. It depends on us. As you can see, this is not Donald Trump talking here. Viktor Orbán says freedom means we can end it if we want it. We are free to do so. Then the next day, Slavoj Žižek appears on the internet, and from a very different angle, he's strangely coinciding with Orbán's optimism. Žižek begins by stating that America's political machinery is broken. He states that the traditional media machine for manufacturing consent spluttered and came to a stop on November 8, 2016. At moments like this, direct fascism can march in, or the new left will provide a new answer. Before the election, he stated he was hoping for Trump to win for the same reason. Žižek, who spares no adjectives calling Trump a dirty, disgusting human being, says that he still looks more human compared to Republican aliens like Ted Cruz or Rick Santorum. His wide and uncensored human baseness is an appeal everyone, but Trump supporters underestimated. It is a moment of truth in the sense that we can clearly see that the ruling ideology that keeps people at check no longer works here. Trump is the result of the failure of the liberal left, according to Žižek, which is an argument that's often been used for Orbán as well. Žižek also talks about breathing easier as Clinton was a bigger threat for a new war. I can only add to that what I heard on the plane from Italy before the emergency landing, what we should do when oxygen masks drop. Respirante normalmente. How come these very different public figures both welcome an event most people I know were terrified of? Even Hungarian far-right supporters would have voted for Clinton rather than having Trump as president, according to a poll conducted just days before the American election. According to the people who say that people can be divided into two groups, the world is once again divided into two groups. One that shouts, this is surreal, and the other one that shouts, it's democracy in action. Or Brexiters would say, it's a sterling example of democracy. Let me clear a couple of misunderstandings at the beginning. One of the common follies is that there's a 50-50 split in the country in people's opinion. No. But if you have only two options, it may look like that. It's like one of those games called Would You Rather, or also called Either. Would you rather have no teeth or have no tongue? Goes one of the questions, and there you go. The country is already split into two. Would you rather lose your keys or lose your cell phone? Would you rather choose non-stop peeing for the rest of your life or non-stop crying for the rest of your life? I know they seem to be forced a tad bit, but the real question is why there are only two choices. What if you only have poor choices to make? None of the candidates were popular enough to be trusted, which created a vacuum which the media tried to fill in with whatever they could. The rise of Trump would have been impossible without the free airtime he got from the media, especially from CNN. Another common misunderstanding is that Putin is high-fiving himself in his mirror now. No. The last thing a despot like Vladimir Putin would want is a populist, especially someone who is whimsical and is often out of control. Putin needs people he can subjugate and manipulate without a risk. Trump, who cannot even control himself, is definitely not a good partner for Vladimir Putin. Another misunderstanding is the notion of the Cold War being back. It's not. There are no rival superpowers. Putin's role is blown out of proportion by the media, and it was only this return of the Cold War narrative that made Russia look important again. Russia's power today is nothing but its powerful image. I think it is also misleading to claim that America rather votes for a Halloween pumpkin than a woman. Not really true. Although after 8 years of Obama, Democrats could have perhaps waited a bit before experimenting. This is not the most progressive of countries after all. No Democratic candidate ever ran on a strong left-wing agenda. Both Clinton in 1992 and Obama in 2008 focused on the economy in times of crisis. They were more centrist, if anything, and they even framed healthcare as an economy issue. Another misunderstanding is that the rise of populist parties is a victory for anti-democratic forces. No. It's actually a byproduct of democratization. According to multiple polls, the overwhelming majority of the people want democracy, but only a third believes that their voices are heard. Democracy and demagogy not only stems from the same word, but one never existed without the other from the very birth of democracy in ancient Greece. Democracy comes from the Greek words demos and kratos, people's rule, just like demos and gogos, leader of the people. It was not meant to be negative originally. The new populism we are focusing on now does not represent a challenge to democracy. Unlike the extremist parties of the 1930s, the new populists do not plan to outlaw elections and introduce dictatorships. In fact, the new populists like elections and often win them. The American elite, just like the European elite, thinks that people do not know what they are doing. They are shocked when they vote for populists and do not understand the anger against the establishment. Populism is defined by the conflict between the people and the elite. We know from experience that populists tend to flourish when they are in opposition and go into crisis when they enter government. Democracy is the rule of the majority, unlike plutocracy, aristocracy, and even meritocracy, where the most talented and the best educated are put into leading positions. Just look at the European Union. Michael Young, the chief architect of Britain's post-war welfare state, who coined the term meritocracy, argued that it would be a disaster as meritocracy would divide society into arrogant winners and angry losers. I'm not trying to draw parallels here. In Europe, even Krastev argues that meritocratic elite is a mercenary elite, not unlike the way the best soccer players are traded around to the most successful clubs across the continent. Successful Dutch bankers move to London, competent German bureaucrats move to Brussels. European institutions and banks, just like soccer clubs, spend colossal amounts of money acquiring the best players. But what happens when these teams start to lose or the economy slows down? The fans abandon them. That's because there's no relationship connecting the players and the fans beyond celebrating victories. They're not from the same neighborhood. You admire the hired stars, but you do not feel sorry for them. Populists, on the other hand, offer loyalty to the local team you are deeply connected with, let it be football or a nation. Populism offers solidarity, not justice. They offer intimacy, not competence. They offer a local team, as opposed to the international players who could be landed anywhere. We should distinguish between left-wing populists such as Bernie Sanders and Podemos's Pablo Iglesias, and right-wing populists such as Donald Trump and Marine Le Pen. Left-wing populists champion the people against an elite or an establishment, against the top. right-wing populists champion the people against the elite, and they accuse of favoring a third group, which can consist, for instance, of immigrants, Islamists, or African-American militants. Right-wing populism is triadic. It looks upward, but also down upon an out-group. It is also authoritarian and identifies with the business class. The rise of populism indicates the decline of the attractiveness of liberal solutions in the fields of politics, economy, culture, and the growing popularity of the politics of exclusion. Populists argue that politics is the expression of the general will of the people, and that the social change, and that social change is possible only via the radical change of the elite. So Viktor Orban of Hungary goes on as if he was not in power, in fact, and looks for an enemy both on the top and below, and he finds it in Brussels and the migrants. Last week in Malta, at the conference of the European People's Party, a conservative group of parties to which both Orban's Fidesz and Angela Merkel's Christian Democrats belong, Viktor Orban refused to be called a populist and claimed it was a leftist criticism without a base. A few years ago, Orban also claimed in an interview that he has never told a lie. So we must assume he believes every word he says. He also mentioned, among others, that migration is the Trojan horse of terrorism, and if this trend continues, there will be a Muslim majority in Western Europe already within our lifetime. But Hungary will continue to defend the borders of the EU no matter what. Orban refuses to be called a populist and claims to be ahead of the curve. He says Europe is lagging behind him in migrant policy. He can sense the new wind. In his view, he's more avant-garde than looking backwards. Perhaps we could call it some kind of jazz democracy, his cooking, which is why still recognizably a democracy, uses improvisation, chance procedure, and just a sprinkle of racism and a drop of misogyny to operate at the very limits of what democracy could be. Jazz is not PC, right? Just an idea. When I was a teenager, I went to dozens of protests, and I saw Orban being arrested and taken away by an undercover police car. He was one of the usual suspects the Secret Service would go after. Orban's rise to political power started at the reburial of Imre Nagy. I was there in 1989, listening to the speech, standing by the coffin of the leader of the Hungarian Revolution of 1956. Orban was the first who publicly demanded the Soviet army leave the country. Orban is unquestionably the most talented Hungarian politician of his era. Since 1989, he has contributed to Hungarian democracy, which led to the country's joining the EU. Orban's personal trauma comes from 2002, when he lost an election, even though the polls showed him in the lead all the way to the count. Since then, his attitude towards politics and power has changed radically. Orban and his party have built up a network and economic power that is nearly impossible to rock. Fidesz has governed for 6 years without an opposition. The role of the opposition was instead played by the European Union, which challenged some parts of the new laws, which then were withdrawn. Orban has undone the system of checks and balances. He's a high risk taker, enjoys confrontation, and handles matters with an authoritarian air to it. Even though he went to Oxford, Orban's language uses a lot of folksy expressions like, it's about as useful as an outhouse on a submarine. Or he would say, freedom is like swimming. If you stop, you go down. Being a swimmer, I can tell you, it doesn't make any sense, unless you're a shark. But it makes a lot of sense when you're swimming in a crowd. The main question about freedom, Orban argued, is it you who make the decisions about your own life or someone else? If your country is not free, you will sink to the level of ethnicity, in reference to swimming, as opposed to a free nation. In the Telegraph interview, he argued, we are not Europeans because we have common European values. This is a misunderstanding. We are Europeans because we have national cultural heritage and values we can harmonize in a common alliance. That is our approach. Europe is not in Brussels, it is in Warsaw, it is in Berlin, in Budapest, in Rome, and in Paris, but not in Brussels. Clearly, the EU is trying to centralize power, and so does Orban, so there is a clash. But it did not seem so troubling as long as it was happening in a country of 10 million people out of 500 million Europeans. But the influence of Orbán is growing, and other countries copy his unorthodox methods, Poland being the latest example. After the American election, one of the first jokes I heard was, "This is how it feels when America is made great again." We have been living that joke for the past 6 years, and the state media machine turned Hungary into an incredible success story. It's not all one big lie. Indeed, the country still looks appealing. Tourism's growth is one of the highest in the world. Unemployment is low. The economy is going relatively well. Even Hungarian football seems to be back unexpectedly, as you may have seen it at the European Championship last year. Orbán promised a strong Hungary, and the country has a greater influence through him internationally than any time in the past decades. One could crack the joke that this is how it feels when Hungary is made great again. But during those 6 years, cracks began to appear on Orbán's system. Many party members became rich and adopted a lifestyle that did not fit with the former image of their party. The propaganda coming from the state television also reminded some people of the former communist regime of Kádár's, and the repeated corruption cases began to undermine the popularity of the party. They went down to nearly 20% in the polls early last year, and the far right was getting closer and closer. And just then, at perfect timing, the refugees and migrants arrived at Viktor Orbán's doorstep. Orbán managed to perform what Trump could only dream of. He actually built a wall in the south and made Europe pay for it. I was raised behind the Iron Curtain in a communist dictatorship that is a solid foundation. My formative years were spent without knowing I was on the wrong side. Maybe I wasn't, who knows. Was there a good side of the Iron Curtain? There are two sides of every wall, the fear side and the hope side. On one side, people have more things. On the other side, people have more dreams. The consumer side of the Iron Curtain was based on fear. Fear of the communists coming and destroying their world. Fear of losing all the goodies they just bought. The other side was based on hope. Perhaps the only good thing about the Iron Curtain was the hope that perhaps it's better on the other side. If you have nothing else, hope is very powerful. If you have a lot of things, you fear of losing it. Things have changed for my country. We are now on the fear side of the new wall we just built, and the refugees are on the hope side. If you are so lucky as to fall into a coma 2 years ago and were spared to witness the American election, you would not believe your eyes if by a twist of fate you'd be woken up in Trump's America. You'd be thinking you arrived in a parallel universe where everything seems to be eerily similar on the surface, but the rules are not the same as home. You'd maybe find it fascinating, as you'd be thinking your friends would laugh their heads off when you tell them the story upon your return. But how will you get back? You keep looking for clues. Then it slowly dawns on you that there is no return. Just like it will slowly dawn on the rest of America too. It hasn't really happened yet. We are still at the stage of fascination. Even those who are screaming hysterically, they are still fascinated by how things are turning out. Life has changed forever. We now live in a new paradigm. There is no going back. You cannot put Trump back into television. Even if America manages to withstand this tsunami of populism, it will be back again, only in a more sophisticated form, using the whole Trump experience. There will come a charismatic populist leader better than Trump, more subtle for sure, not making huge blunders on a weekly basis. A true demagogue from ancient Athens who will be loved, a leader of the pack people would die for, and he will be feared and not laughed at like the 70-year-old man-child with the golden hair. The next Trump will take it to the next level and doing it deliberately by copying a successful strategy. A lot of our problems stem from the media. The reason why humans are so successful is because the way we connect, which also enables us to massacre each other very successfully depending on the information we receive. The way information is passed on is crucial. Now, if information becomes entertainment, our brain becomes a circus. You get less and less interested in the news unless it is presented like a show. You get addicted to it, and just like hard drugs, it slowly kills your ability to get excited from anything less than your weekly dose of body count. When the media becomes a circus, it is only a matter of time until a clown comes and steals the show. Now, the man who is making America great again. Do you remember the time when we thought that we hit rock bottom with George W. Bush? Trump can say the worst racist stuff that would have gotten you fired from any other job. Trump proves that if you believe passionately that you're doing the right thing, only the sky is the limit. Today we got to the point when it's not news if it's not Trump. When you talk about something else, everybody notices you're talking about something else. The media doesn't know what it's doing. CNN coverage of Trump was a key contribution to his victory. They practically elected Donald Trump, or at least made him one of the two choices in the Would You Rather game. Trump's campaign strategy could only work with this much media attention, saying nothing but repeating it over and over again until it sticks. If your head is overloaded with fake news, they will become an influencer your everyday, just like a piece of music stuck in your head, like a so-called earworm. Repetition creates a pattern, and you think along patterns. Even if your original attitude was disbelief, it is the pattern that remains. The assessment is washed away with time, and there is no pressure from your environment or no time to assess. One may argue that there is a natural selection of news, and their success is not necessarily based on their truth value. We could claim that the American election is massively about propaganda. Before a reality show character appeared, candidates used to compete for the claim of being closer to the truth than the other person. With the election of Trump, there is a new paradigm. There are competing fictions nominated for the truth. The intuitive truth behind the scene has become more important than the correspondence to actual facts. If their idea of truth is accepted by the majority, it will become the truth. Reality is community-based. There can be breakaway communities that become dominant in time if other communities fail to react to the challenge of the day. No one believed in the 20s that the Nazis could actually seize power over the whole of Germany, just like no one believed a decade later that their power could be reversed. The President of the United States is the executive director of a reality show, and he's running the country accordingly. When we talk about real, it is in this context of a reality show in the White House today. It is a constructed reality, just like the first official portrait of Melania Trump, heavily photoshopped in the manner of alternative facts. Americans are now shocked to see that they are just another country. Less manifest than ever, that this could happen to them, not just to a banana republic in Central America, which would then probably be the work of CIA. Then they are shocked to see that history is not just something that happens to other countries, that there is chaos at the airports, that there are Jewish cemeteries destroyed, that their president is insulting other heads of state, that the coal mines are reopening, and the White House press secretary opened his job with a lie. Every week there is something they would have never thought of before. But America is not just another country, unfortunately, because the man of the hour is also the keeper of the launch codes. He's in command of a military that can destroy the whole planet. Some of the biggest Hollywood hits are escapist fantasies like Star Wars, Jurassic Park, Avatar, but it's even more the case with the news media. The news media is rife with propaganda, and if you don't see it, it means you have already been indoctrinated. This includes American and Hungarian news media, which I both happened to experience. You open anything with news on it, and you always know immediately who is on what team. It's almost like a sport event. Also, people are reading 140-character think pieces. It turns out you can recruit suicide bombers and teenage wives in 140 characters, which means not everything is as complicated as it seems. In forms of communication like this, you can only tell to the people what they expect to hear. You only have to wing, and they will misunderstand you exactly the way they want to. The internet has created its echo chambers that are used not to open minds, but exactly to limit your train of thoughts depending on the level of your cognitive dissonance and denial. If you take a step away, though, and look at America, this is nothing compared to a dictatorship. Real dictators would look at Trump as a liberal softie, as a tree-hugger Twitter bug. This is nothing yet. The next guy will be a lot more dangerous. In the worst-case scenario, someone in the future may say, where are the good old days when you could just say something in public and the president would tweet about it during his 5 a.m. bowel movement next morning? The future Trump will tweet about what you were actually thinking on the toilet in the era of total surveillance. Seems like the future is facing a shortage of facts. If you're dealing with facts the way it does now, if it goes now, our world will be facing a shortage of truth and not water. But do we need truth like we need water? Who would have thought that the greatest show on earth is in the White House? It is American politics now. With the news media turning infotainment, it was only a matter of time politics is derailed by a showman. You need showmanship, not truth. This election had made it clearer than ever. But that's not enough. You also need an unconvincing, power-hungry opponent smeared with scandals. The recipe was the same in many European countries, including mine. The real question is how to get rid of them. I heard people expressing views that outside the Civil War, this is the single most cataclysmic event in American history. Many people think this is the worst thing that happened in their life, which is again similar to feelings of many Europeans about their own leaders. Here we are trapped in a reality show of democracy, wondering if it's going to really hurt or is it just an aggressive wasting of our time. Let's be clear. Everything we have now will influence other things. This is not going to just disappear, but it is the beginning of something else. That goes down to the small. It's the beginning of something that goes down to the smallest details, that goes down to role models as well. So many young girls are now dreaming that they too perhaps someday could be kneeling on the couch of the Oval Office just like Kellyanne did. The Cold War was a consequence of the Second World War, and its reverberations were still felt in the past decades. People in the West lived in peace for a very long time. They lived in a bubble of a myth or denial that the war can never happen again. That is now finally washed away. The Second World War is over, by which I mean the peaceful period that followed the war is over, and the players are now open to something new based on a different idea of truth. This is characterized by events like people complaining online about the correct spelling of Sieg Heil, or the president forgetting to mention Jews on Holocaust Day. The Second World War is finally over after a long agony. We live in a new paradigm now. With the old elite and experts out of the window, the official keepers of memory are also being replaced. So back to Europe. The United Kingdom, from now on referred to as the Kingdom, is in a process of divorce with Europe, and we don't know yet who gets to keep Scotland. There is a growing anxiety in Europe that the populist wave cannot be reversed. The idea of a continent of culture is damaged by the divisions brought on by the euro and the migration crisis. Demoralized by Brexit, the Union now stands between revisionist Russia, no longer in the guise of the Soviet Union, and Trump's America First, not mentioning Turkey's new stance. On the other hand, Americans may help Europeans to get over their identity crisis. The Austrian victory over the far-right presidential candidate Norbert Hofer in December could be interpreted as a European reaction to Trump's victory. Wilders' far-right party was also beaten in Holland. European populists became increasingly arrogant after the American election, feeling wind in their sails, which made undecided voters less likely to go for the radical experiment. You may argue that Trump actually did a service to Europe. The conservative revolution may actually breathe new life into EU-friendly patriotism. The coming elections in France, Germany, and the Czech Republic will speak for themselves. Donald Tusk, the president of the European Council, defined the present situation with Trump's America together with Russia, China, and radical Islam as the biggest existential threat the European Union ever faced, among with lack of faith in the integration and national egoism. Tusk, a poll from Danzig, where only two generations ago Nazis classified Polish people as subhuman, wrote a love letter about the EU to the 27 heads of state, calling for courage and solidarity. In the face of national egoism and xenophobia, it must be made clear, Tusk argues, that the disintegration of the European Union will not lead to the restoration of some mythical full sovereignty of its member states, but to the real and factual dependence on the great superpowers like the United States, Russia, and China. Only together can we be fully independent. Tusk invites members to take integration to the next level, reinforce the borders, improve cooperation to combat terrorism, increase military spending, and better coordinate member states' foreign policies. This one is obviously for Poland and Hungary. Tusk also speaks of the economy and how the EU should use the change in the American trade strategy to her own advantage. While we cannot surrender to those who want to weaken or invalidate the transatlantic bond, without which global order and peace cannot survive, we should remind our American friends of their own motto: united we stand, divided we fall. It was end of January before the Malta summit.